Skye Duncan is a top international urban designer. Having worked in the New York City Department of City Planning, she's now leading a program funded by Bloomberg Philanthropies to help cities around the world make their streets safe and sustainable. She's been back in New Zealand talking to transport organisations about sustainable mobility. I asked what that means.
Sustainable mobility means when we design our cities and streets to give people choices of how to get around. So sustainable mobility means that it's lower carbon emissions, that it's cleaner, that it helps to facilitate healthy kind of neighbourhoods and communities where people have choices, and that it's safe to walk and bike and take transit, and that not, you know, the only option that we're giving people is not to get in their cars and drive around.
And that's your biggest problem, I imagine. I know you've worked in areas which are intensely urban, intensely dominated by cars.
Absolutely.
How do you get rid of them without sort of sending them somewhere else to snarl another bit of the city up?
Yeah, no, it's a really good question, and it's a big challenge, and it certainly doesn't come without controversy, this work. We've got to do a couple of things. We have to get really kind of closely integrated land use and density planning with our transportation options. And then we have to give people better choices, essentially. We're funny as human beings. We tend to take kind of the easiest and most convenient choice. So if it's easier for somebody to walk for 5 minutes, get a bus, be comfortable, hop off, maybe either walk or grab a bike on a bike share to get to their job, they're more likely to do that if that whole journey maybe takes, say, 20 minutes than sitting in a car for an hour and a half. In the same way that a regular routine of a family member, a caregiver with a couple of kids who maybe has to make a bunch of stops throughout the day, if they have kind of feasible options to them, that is the choice that they're going to make. And sadly, what we've done is we really haven't given those choices to most members of society, not only in New Zealand, but around the world. Because of the way we've planned our cities, we've kind of got sprawling environments where people are living out on the outskirts of cities. They're not done with a land use mix of all the types of things we need on a daily basis. So, you know, a park and a school and a healthy food supermarket, maybe some local shops and restaurants or a healthcare clinic. What we've done is we've kind of separated that stuff out in our cities so that people have to travel huge distances. And then we haven't given them ways to get across that distance, you know, except for driving in a car. So it's really kind of it is a comprehensive effort that we have to look at in terms of how we design our cities. But we have many, many examples around the world of how to do this well and where that default decision has been to move about by transit, by train, by bike or by walking.
You worked in places with very high populations, very dense populations. One of New Zealand's problems, I suggest, is that we actually haven't got enough people to make public transport a financial option in many places.
Well, we tell ourselves that. But actually, when you look at many parts of the world, I think what we've been doing is forgetting that access to the city and access to reliable public transit should be a basic right as a citizen. We haven't really valued it in society to the same degree of kind of a simple education, healthy food, access to clean air. You know, many parts of the world, you look at cities like Helsinki, or, you know, there are about 600,000 people, or Valencia with 2 million people, Bordeaux, small cities of 200,000 or 300,000 people. These cities have pretty comprehensive, you know, public transit networks and really comprehensive bike facilities. So we've kind of, I think, you know, I've been hearing us say this in New Zealand, and I used to believe it myself a little bit and kind of use that excuse. But as we've been, you know, as I've been kind of traveling the world and seeing the different cities, I think actually in New Zealand, we don't have any excuses compared to most parts of the world.
Don't come here and take our excuses away from us. Tell me what you did in Times Square.
Well, so Times Square, my boss, Jeanette Sutter Khan, who's our board chair, she took on this project under the Mike Bloomberg administration. And this was a project to really kind of readdress one of our most critical assets in our cities, which is our streets. This typically takes up 80% of our public space, which means that as cities, it's one of our biggest kind of untapped assets you think about the value we put on private real estate, right? Yet what we do with our public space, we should really be rethinking kind of every square inch or square meter of space and who that's serving and how it's serving them. So in Times Square, Jeanette very boldly suggested closing the intersection as one of the busiest intersections in the world. And as you can imagine, it got a fair amount of pushback, right? We as human beings, we don't tend to overly embrace change. We find it scary and daunting to think about a different alternative for the future. So what they did was they said, okay, let's trial this for 6 months, right? If it's a disaster, we will bring back all the cars. But the reality was, because they'd done their homework, 89% of the space was being given to cars, but 89% of the people, of the people in the space, were people walking, right? So it was a kind of a complete inverted mismatch of who was there and who was getting all the space. So for the six-month trial, they closed it. They put out some beach chairs, put down a bit of paint, and they collected a lot of data. Mike Bloomberg, he's a very big data guy. One of his famous sayings is, you know, in God we trust and everybody else must bring data. Mm. And so they measured, right? What were the average speeds of the taxis? What was the bus ridership? Well, it went up. What was the air quality? It improved. Did people prefer it? Yes, the vast majority of people preferred it. The businesses ended up doing better. It was safer. The crashes, the injuries went down. So, you know, every metric that was measured showed that, in fact, this kind of very radical change or radical rethinking was, in fact, a very successful move. And based on that, they were able to move forward and make that permanent. And it was very powerful, I think, as a trigger for a lot of the work, you know, happening in the US and around the world now, because it helped us shift from anecdote to analysis. And, you know, it's really important to capture the stories and understand how people are experiencing spaces and, you know, their daily challenges and daily opportunities. But it's also really important that we don't let that trump what the numbers are. Often the kind of a very noisy minority end up taking the headlines of the newspapers and, you know, whereas actually the majority of people may be benefiting from that. So it's complicated, but that project really was a great success. And what was powerful was that it built a demand amongst the community, because it wasn't only Times Square, of course, that's the big famous one in the middle of Manhattan, but these types of transformations were done in neighborhoods all over New York City. And when the new mayor came in and wanted to actually try and tear Times Square out, everybody kind of came back in protest and said, no way, you can't do that. How can you take away? And of course, they won, right? The project stays. Times Square is still pedestrian. And it kind of goes to show how we as humans, while we hate change, we can also be quite nimble, and often it's very easy to forget what was there before.
So where did all the traffic go?
So there's a technical term in engineering called induced demand. And what it essentially means is that a number of things. So some people don't take that trip at all, right? They say, you know what, I was going to go and visit so-and-so, but I'm not going to visit now, right? So they don't take the trip in their car. In some cases, people say, oh, I need to pick up my dry cleaning. You know what, instead of doing that today, I'm going to do that on my way to work tomorrow, right? So they kind of couple their trips and reduce the overall number of trips. Some people say, well, you know what, now that's going to take me, or I think it's going to take me a lot longer, so let me bike or let me take a bus down, right? So they pick a different mode, and then some people don't change. But it's kind of this idea of traffic evaporation. And it seems counterintuitive, but we now know, because what we've got these kind of phenomenal experiments around the world where we've been stuck in this self-fulfilling prophecy, right, where we've thought, oh my gosh, it's so congested. We have to add another lane. We have to widen the lane because we need more space for cars. Now, what we've seen is that that works sometimes for a very short period of time, a couple of weeks, a couple of months, if we're lucky. But actually then it fills up and the congestion gets worse. And so all the meanwhile, we kind of keep going through the cycle. And this is essentially what we've been doing for the last, you know, 50 years in our cities. And we've been making our cities incredibly dangerous, in many cases quite unlivable, and, you know, quite stressful for a lot of people. And so we know now, it seems counterintuitive, but the opposite is true. If we dedicate space for mass transit so that somebody can take a bus and say get there, or a tram or a light rail, that they could get there by, say, 20 minutes, right? Because there's no other vehicles in that car lane or that travel lane. So the transit gets priority, and it doesn't sit there in traffic, right? So people will start, we can move many, many more people. If we give that space to protected bicycle facilities, that mean everyone from an elderly active person to an 8-year-old, you know, have an option to safely bike around the city or to walk. We know we can move, you know, 2.5 times as many people just by drawing those lines within the roadbed in a different way and distributing that space between different users in a more effective way.
So you have to put up with the flack and complaints for a short while, and then you have to trust that people will discover that they quite like what they now have to do.
Exactly. And it takes, you know, it can take a long time. And there, of course, is a lot of flack, not just for me, for politicians all around the world. And I think that's what's been tough, right, with often very kind of short political administrations. We don't see political leaders willing to put their kind of neck out there to make decisions that sometimes in the short term are going to be very, very, or seem to be very problematic. But actually long term, we know that this is the direction you have to go. You know, I was in Copenhagen a couple of weeks ago for a conference, and you wouldn't dream of not having a bike with you there, right? Because it's really hard to drive, and the default, it's very totally easy. You don't even think twice about it, about biking everywhere. In New York, I was offered, actually, my auntie a few years ago offered me a car, and for a split second I thought, oh, awesome, you know, I'll be able to go away on the weekend. And then I realized, what a nightmare. Having a car in New York is a total nightmare. You know, it's way easier to have this kind of mix of use the subway, take the bus, take a bike, walk around, and of course, occasionally take a you know, rent a car or do car share. And I think we're often kind of miss this whole conversation. Often gets interpreted as, you know, being super anti-car. And that's not true. It's actually about just being pro-choice and giving people alternatives that are not only going to keep them safer, but improve their health and make sure they have kind of a happier, more joyful life.
I mean, I get what you're saying, but when you frame it as pro-choice, I begin to feel a bit squirmy, because it's only pro-choice if you make what hitherto has been chosen increasingly uncomfortable or impossible.
Yes, you do have to make the other alternatives better. And whether we like it or not...
No, it's not even that. It's saying, we know that most of you have chosen to drive a car before, but yep, we're not going to let you do that in Times Square anymore. So while you frame it as saying increasing choice, I'm calling you that's PR spin.
Well, but the opposite is true, right? What we've done with the majority of our public space, which is our streets and our cities, is we're not giving the most fundamental users the right to use the space safely. Because when we've given all of that space to private cars, we've got air pollutants that are now killing people. Close to 7 million people are dying prematurely every year because of air pollution, and a huge portion of that are the vehicles on our streets, right? Schools in Delhi last week were closed because of the quality of the air. Not all transportation, it's the fires there as well and the climate. But we're now finding air pollutants in a mother's placenta after a baby is born, right? So we're killing people slowly because of the air, also because we have close to 40 million people dying prematurely from chronic disease, because a big portion of which is a lack of physical activity, because we've made our streets so unsafe that our kids can no longer walk to school or bike to school. And we're killing people. The number one killer around the world is people dying from road traffic fatalities, ages 5 to 29. So we are killing our young people day after day after day because of how we've designed our streets. So I think we do have to look at it fairly. And yes, we do have a high, you know, car ownership rate and ridership rate in New Zealand. But the majority of the people in the world can't actually afford to own a car. And we think we can because we're not actually paying the real costs of that at the moment. And, you know, the cost of the infrastructure for car-orientated societies, the real costs of of extracting gasoline or petrol, and you know the later health costs that society is bearing because of these decisions we've made. So it's not really PR. It's really kind of based at core in evidence. You guys in New Zealand, you have 377 people die every year on the streets of New Zealand.
Yep. No, I'm absolutely not disputing that it would be nice if far fewer cars dominated our streets.
Mm-hmm.
But when you say we're just giving people more choice, if I'm a car driver, mm-hmm. I'm going to say, no, you're not. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah, I mean, look, I would respectfully disagree, because I think we are giving you more choice. We would be giving you by investing in transit and safer alternatives, you're actually giving people more choice. You're not saying you can't ever drive, right? You may have to take a slightly different route, or it's probably going to take you a little longer potentially. But the alternative is you're getting safer options where you're going to be able to live longer and
breathe cleaner air. I want to drive my car. I mean, this is visceral. You know, because you've been far more than I. That's right. Cars are kind of an extension of a part of your body.
But we used to think that about the cigarette, right? It's funny, like when we were trying to make like ban smoking and restaurants and parks and so forth. No way, you can't do that. I have the right. It's my right to be able to smoke, right? Yeah. It's my body. I'm allowed to do that. We would never have thought that. Now, I don't know here, but now when I travel, I go into a place where there's, you know, smoking in aeroplanes and smoking in restaurants. It's insane. You think, how did we ever let that happen?
Mm.
Right? We used to think that we would never need electricity in all of our homes, or that we would never need internet in all of our homes. You know, I've been having these conversations recently with a gentleman in LA. He's the consulate for New Zealand there, and he was explaining it when they were talking about giving 5G or internet in New Zealand. Everyone's saying, no, there's no way we would need that in rural areas or in everybody's home, right? So we're very strong as a society in kind of getting stuck in our ways and not being able to see the future. But I do honestly believe that once we get there, and I've literally, and I think many of us have seen this in other places, what that alternative future could look like. And it would be very hard to debate once we get there.
What are you thinking of? What's your kind of vision?
So I'd have to say most of the leading examples that would be most relevant to New Zealand, I think, are in Europe or Scandinavia areas where there are cars, you know. I mean, some cities, Madrid, Oslo, they've banned cars in the downtown area so far to great success. But there are cars in the city. It's not to say you can't ever have a car, but you have choices. There's reliable, frequent transit that you can get around. These are cities half the size or a quarter of the size of Auckland, right? So this could be relevant for Dunedin and Christchurch and Wellington and Auckland. You know, you can take transit, you can bike, you can walk, you could get a car share. You've got options, right? And we as individuals, we're quite different. We have different daily routines. People are increasingly working at home, working remotely. You know, once you've got kids and family members moving around the city, not as an individual, but as, you know, being responsible for others, is really important. And to not have to kind of be able to stick to a routine. And so I think, you know, I've seen it. I've kind of experienced these types of environments where the air is cleaner and the water is cleaner and the streets are safer. And it's pretty amazing. And I think there's absolutely no reason that we have in New Zealand to not strive for that and to not achieve it, particularly with the kind of leadership of, you know, I loved what Jacinda was saying last week with the launch of the Zero Carbon Act, right? Like New Zealand, we cannot and should not be slow followers. This is a time that we should be kind of showing the world how it's done. And there's zero reason why Auckland, Wellington, all of our cities here shouldn't be like absolute world class and setting example for others.
As an expression, is it tactical urban planning?
Yep.
Is that what you were referring to when you said in Times Square you put some beach chairs and a lick of paint around the place and said, you know, try it and see
exactly.
If you like it?
So there's many names. It's like an interim project, a pilot, tactical urbanism. And what's so powerful about this, Kim, is people have often never had the chance to experience or see their streets in any other way than it moving vehicles or storing metal boxes, right? Now, when we do community engagement, which is fundamentally important when we're doing these types of changes, it's very different when we do that on a piece of paper and someone's pointing and looking versus when you can stand in that space and you can see your kids playing and meet your neighbours. And it all sounds very fairy tale-ish, but it kind of is, right? Once you actually experience that, it's a whole different story. And so often these tactical urbanism or this kind of interim interventions, it allows this kind of trial process where it reduces people's fear of change, right? So if it doesn't work, we'll give it all back to the cars. But it, we want, you know, you want to implement it for long enough that people can get used to it, can trial it, and to use that new space as a platform for community engagement to say, okay, look, right now this is painted pink and purple and orange or whatever it is. What would you like to see here in your community, right? Would you like to see more trees? Do you have a lack of playgrounds? Would you like kind of more hardscape plaza, cafe style, you know, that kind? Do you need an event space for your community to do outdoor movies? So it becomes kind of this place where the interim intervention or the tactical version is not the final version, but it really is the platform to open up a conversation to say, what do we want to see in our cities? I mean, this streets are public space. We forget about that. It's public space.
It's interesting, there's psychology involved in that as well, isn't it? Because you're also saying to people, look, just let's play around with this. We're not going to commit to it. We're not going to trap you into anything. Let's just see what happens.
Yeah. And look, honestly, there are certainly times where it doesn't work and there's huge protests and people really hate it. And sure, if the majority of people really don't want something, then you can take it out and give it back to the cars. But you know what? There's so many people out there who do want it and do want their kids to be healthy and to have choices of how to get around because they can't afford to drive. They can't afford to own a car. And it's only going to get more and more expensive. So when we look at people's often kind of limited budgets of what they get to spend their money on and how they spend their time, I think people are starting to wake up and realise that, you know, sometimes the alternatives are actually a whole lot better.
This is a very flash job you have. How did you get from here to there?
Good question. So I'm from Dunedin originally and studied architecture at Victoria in Wellington. So did my degree there. Then I worked for a few years in Wellington at Rate & Associates Landscape Architects and then at Ian Athfield's office. And in 2006, I was awarded a Fulbright scholarship to go and do my master's at Columbia University in New York City. So I did that. I studied my master's in architecture and urban design. And when I was finishing, Mike Bloomberg was mayor of New York at the time, and the city planning department was setting up a new urban design division. And one of my professors suggested I go and interview there, so I did. I got the job. And so for 8 years, I was working at the planning department in New York City under the Office of Chief Urban Designer, and then I was teaching at Columbia University in the same master's program I went through. And when Mike Bloomberg left government, Jeanette Sadik-Khan reached out to me and asked me if I would be willing to kind of take on this role of heading up the Global Designing Cities initiative that was essentially kind of taking some of the successes and lessons from the North American context to an international scale. And so I thought about it and at the time was also considering coming back to New Zealand to help with some of the kind of post-earthquake work in Christchurch. But decided that, you know, this chance to kind of go and work with cities around the world and, you know, be able to kind of share these lessons and help us all, you know, borrow and steal ideas and adapt them to our local contexts would really, you know, be kind of a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. So I took that on. And that was 5 years ago. It's our fifth birthday of GDCI this month, actually.
And a lot of this work is funded by the Bloomberg Foundation, right?
Correct.
And what is it that Michael Bloomberg cares about in order to put so much money into other parts of the world?
Yeah, so he's...
apart from being president at the moment, it seems.
Yeah, let's see. Uh-huh. It's super interesting. Uh-huh. So he has the Bloomberg Philanthropies, which is the philanthropic arm of his work. And he has a few areas that he's particularly passionate about. Sustainable cities. He has a lot of passion around gun reform in the United States and public health. He really kind of fundamentally understands this role of how our built environment, how our cities and communities shape us and our health. And a big part of the kind of bottom line is how many lives can be saved. And so through the Bloomberg Philanthropies Initiative for Global Road Safety, we get not all of our funding, but a core part of our funding where we partner. It's really cool. It's a very kind of comprehensive approach where we work with people who work in enforcement, who work in media campaigns, Johns Hopkins University, data collection, all of this kind of comprehensive approach to how do we help cities implement these best practices on the ground. And so we're kind of part of that cohort. And he understands that, you know, sometimes this stuff is complex, but it takes a long time. Climate and air pollution is another big one of his passions, and also art and the creatives field. So it's really fun to kind of be able to bring a lot of this stuff together in an exciting way, but in a way that at the end of the day, you know, you're helping people get home to their families alive. And
what's the place you've worked in that you think you've made the most radical change to?
I would probably have to say there's a small, well, not small, small in the global scale, city called Fortaleza in the north of Brazil. And there are a few million people, and they've got a phenomenal mayor there who has a public health background. So he really gets this. And he's hired some really, really smart people. And these guys have taken kind of global best practice. They're not a wealthy city, but they have adapted these to their context and their needs. And, you know, we've helped them launch public space programs where they're rethinking neighborhood hearts, redesigning streets, using these incredibly kind of vibrant colors to totally give people a new understanding of what streets could be in their cities. They're implementing huge networks of protected bike lanes and also investing in public transit. They're doing amazing things like creating bike share for kids, you know, and doing long-term bike share that help to serve some of their underserved communities. And what's been really exciting, actually, is that they are one of the very few cities in the world who are on track to meet one of the Sustainable Development Goals, which was to halve fatalities by the year 2020. Now, funny story, that was actually a mistake when they were voting on this particular Sustainable Development Goal. It was written as 2030, but someone in the room put up their hand and said, no, I think it's meant to be 2020. So they changed it, which means the majority of cities around the world are not going to meet that goal. But this city, Fortaleza, is actually on track. We've got a few months to go, but is actually on track of meeting that mistaken goal. So in the last 4 to 5 years, they have halved the number of people dying on their streets through this very kind of comprehensive approach, you know, using data, using metrics, working with the media, training the journalists so that they understand the issues, and then physically implementing projects that are developing a new reality on the streets there.
Skye Duncan.